So when I look at a mining stock, the first thing I do is I just ignore the price of gold and what the price of gold is going to do in the next 6 months, in the next 12 months, in the next 5 years. I take that out of the equation from the beginning and I start to do the due diligence.
This episode of MiningStockEducation.com is brought to you by Sandstorm Gold Royalties. Sandstorm Gold Royalties is a different kind of gold company. They purchase royalties on select mining operations and receive a percentage of the revenue in return. Sandstorm now has a portfolio of nearly 190 gold royalties around the world. See how gold royalties differ from other gold mining investments at sandstormgold.com. That's sandstormgold.com. Sandstorm Gold Royalties trades on the TSX as SSL and on the NYSE American as SAND. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Bill Powers, your host, and this is the Mining Stock Education Podcast. And I have a special guest for this episode that I reached out to so that he could share his investment journey and his approach to mining stock investing. Over my educational career, I've sat through a number of lectures in the classroom, and a common misperception that I've seen among students is the thought that the teacher is the fountain of all knowledge, that the teacher knows everything in the classroom, when oftentimes it could be a student with a question or a student with an insight, and that insight actually can surpass the knowledge of many things the teacher is teaching about. So oftentimes it may not be recognized as such just because that person's not standing behind a podium. Well, if we can relate that to the junior investment sector, you have the newsletter writers, you have the people with the notoriety that are known for their insights that we look to gain insights on how to better invest in the junior mining sector. But often, because of the rise of the internet, there can be people in the classroom, so to speak, that may at times have more insightful things to say and to offer than the person behind the podium. Well, one person today is Luis. He's the Economic Alpha on Twitter. He's grown substantially of recent. He has thousands of Twitter followers that look to him for investing insights because he shares what he's doing with his capital as he's journeying along in the junior mining investment sector. So, Luis, thanks for coming on the Mining Stock Education Podcast to share your insights with us.
Well, thank you, Bill, for that warm introduction. Thanks a lot, and I'm looking forward to this interview.
Yeah, let's start with your Twitter handle, Economic Alpha. What's behind that?
Didn't put a lot of effort into that one, to be honest. It was quite frankly the fact that I have an economics background. I graduated with a degree in economics, and the alpha component to it was just, wanting to make a rate of return in excess of the market return. And so I combined the two together to create at Economic Alpha. And that's really the story of my Twitter handle.
And then can you give us a little more info on your background and how you came to invest in mining stocks?
So I started my corporate career in early 2000. And I started in underwriting and risk management. Not the investment bank underwriting that most folks think about. It's really insurance underwriting. And my background, it consists of risk management as well. So the two themes of my corporate career, underwriting and risk management, I apply to investing in general, not just mining stocks. It just so happened to work out where these attributes that I have gained in my corporate career is panning out quite well in the mining sector.
And when did you buy your first mining stock?
I bought my first mining stock. I would call it more my first investment in the space was in GLD, the ETF. That was around 2006. And I bought my first mining stock not too far after that. Company called Claude Resources. They were out in Saskatoon, Canada. And I ventured into that opportunity, small junior mining company that was producing 40 to 50,000 ounces a year in gold. So that was my first investment in the industry.
And then as you began to invest in the junior resource sector, you know, the learning curve, in my opinion, is quite high for this tiny little specialized sector. What were some of the most difficult things that you had to learn or overcome to begin to do this successfully?
First and foremost, I think the biggest issue I had was just the technical aspect of it. You know, unlike buying a stock that everyone knows, like a Starbucks or an Apple or a consumer stock or even a chip company or anything to that effect, there might be some technical aspects to it, but not the significant amount of technical aptitude that you need for mining stocks. Even in oil companies, it's the same technical concepts that you have to grasp. And because I don't have a background in a background in this technical aspect of the industry, it definitely set me back quite a bit. The learning curve for that was, I think, the highest and biggest challenge. The second issue that I had was the preconceived notion that if you buy a mining stock and the gold price goes up, or a silver stock and the silver price goes up, that the underlying stock is going to go up as well. And while that may be true, it's not always the case. And so that's where my background in underwriting and risk management come into play, because you really have to look at the company in its totality. Sure, if you buy a gold stock and you catch a gold bull market, chances are that all of the, not all, but the majority of the gold stocks are going to rise as well, as a rising tide lifts all boats. But that's not always the case. And in particular, it is not the case in a time period like we are in now, where the gold price hasn't done anything. I mean, the mm-hmm. gold price has been trading in a range for as long as I can remember, at least since my son's been born. I mean, he's 4, and you know, the price of gold is around the same price as it was when he was born. So there really hasn't been any movement in the gold price. So when you have an environment where price isn't moving, or it's actually falling, or it's in just one tradable range, it's important to kind of do significant due diligence on a mining stock. So I think those two combinations, the technical side of it, plus the due diligence side of it, and what to look for and what's important, and all these different questions that you have to ask yourself while you're going through the process. And that takes a lot of time and a lot of effort. And it's not the easiest thing. And so it takes time to understand and learn that. And I think that's why the industry started and came out with these ETFs, you know, the GDX and the GDXJ. But those things have their own issues as well.
From 2011 and 2012 until 2016, and somewhat carried on to today, we've been in a bear market. How did you manage your portfolio during that time period? What did you do with your mining portfolio?
Not a whole lot, and I'll tell you why. So I had bought Claude Resources. I had mentioned a little bit earlier that I bought that one, not shortly after I bought GLD. And that was a stock that I held on to during the bear market, and it really took a nosedive. Now, I held on to it because of my own, I guess arrogance, thinking that, you know, I thought it was going to do well, and that I thought that things were going to go in the right direction regardless of the market that we were in. And so I rode that company down all the way down to, 14 cents when it hit 14 cents. I think it was in 2014. But while I was writing it down, I had 75-80% losses in the company. I learned a lot. I think that was the point in time where I learned, I guess you want to call it, for lack of a better phrase, the school hard knocks. I was sitting on a big loss. But while I was sitting on a big loss, I wasn't just sitting around hoping and praying. I started to then get more involved with the company. I started calling investor relations. I started having dialogue with management. I started asking questions. I started, after conference calls, I would call in and dial in and ask questions at the conference calls, and started to build a rapport much more than I had ever done before. And I think it was because I was down so much that I had to force myself to figure out what went wrong and how I could manage to improve the situation. So, right or wrong, I held on to it. And that was a really tough experience. But I believe that experience created the opportunities that I'm going through now.
Did you average down through the years, or did you just take that initial position and then leave it there?
I had taken probably 25% of the position initially. rode that down. As the price kept going down, I did start to buy it as it was going down, but not because I was hoping that that was the right thing. As I was saying earlier, that was when I started to get more comfortable with the company beyond where I was before with it. And they had started to hit some pretty high grade results at the CB mine, which they called it the Santoy Gap. And I started to see something a little different than what I had seen originally. So the bear market took the price down. The operations of the company took the price down. Everything was going against the company. And so that's why the stock price went down as low as it did. But as that was happening, having been more involved in the name and doing more due diligence, I started to get a different understanding of what was going on and actually presented an opportunity. So I did start buying more and averaging down even more to a point where I built a pretty big position and took my average cost down significantly from my initial investment. So yeah, I did average down. It probably wasn't the right thing to do at the time, but in hindsight, it turned out to be the right decision.
You like gold stocks, and I'm gathering that just from following you on Twitter. Do you believe we're in a confirmed gold bull market right now, or what's your expectation with gold?
My expectation with gold is it's going to still stay in this trading range that it's been on, unless it breaks, 1365, 1370 on the upside, or the lows last year I think were 1125, and then the bear market lows I think was 1050. Those are the ranges really that I'm looking at. So as long as we stay above prior year low and don't break the 1050 bear market low, I believe we're still going to stay in a range, especially if we can't get ahead of or above 1370. Now, there's speculation that the Fed is going to be pausing rates. We're heading into a seasonal time period where gold tends to do well. So there's a lot of factors that could affect the price in the short term. But in the longer term scheme, as long as those ranges are still intact from a technical standpoint, we're still in a very large trading range, a couple hundred dollars an ounce.
You seem to do a lot of fundamental analysis before you take a position, and then it appears you take a position more for a long position. But do you trade at all? Like you mentioned, the seasonality that we're coming into with gold. What does a trade look like for you?
Yeah, so when I started doing it, it was really more concentrated positions in mining stocks, stocks that I had a comfort level in. And then as I began to build a portfolio a little bit, there was additional capital that I began applying to just trading them. And so sometimes I trade in a very short window, same day. So sometimes I'll day trade something. Sometimes I'll trade into a catalyst that may be coming ahead. And sometimes I'll just try to trade the volatility of technical setups in the chart or technical setups in the price of gold. And sometimes I'll trade ahead of economic events like the Fed interest rate decision or, GDP data or something to that effect.
Do you trade the leveraged ETFs?
I don't. I avoid all of those leveraged mining stock ETFs just from a decay standpoint. The volatility is just too wide for me. And, I guess I could if I wanted to day trade it, but it's just something I personally stayed away from.
What about the breakdown of your portfolio right now? Between explorers, developers, producers, royalty companies, ETFs, like percentage-wise, what does your portfolio look like?
So the portfolio right now, I've fine-tuned it quite significantly over the past 6 months. If you recall back in the summer, the price of gold took a big dip down. Actually, not just during the summer, but since the highs, I think, that were reached in April. I believe it was like 1360 or so, and the price subsequently went down slow, but then I felt like it went down all at once in the summer, all the way down to 1170. And so I repositioned my portfolio during that time and really just got rid of the explorers and any kind of day trades that I was doing, and just, you know, raised some cash and really just kept my core portfolio intact. And when I say core, I'm talking about names that I'm very comfortable with, names that are producers, that have cash flow, that generate free cash flow, that have somewhat of an agnostic price to gold mentality. And that's where my portfolio is today. It's really defensive, but not necessarily defensive where if the price of gold went up significantly, that I wouldn't capture any of that upside. It's just defensive in nature, and that's how I would describe it as it stands right now.
You're actually looking at gold mining companies as a business. You want to see cash flow and catalysts would be those would be like the two things, primary things you'd look for.
Yeah, I'm not good with just buying a gold stock and hope that the price of gold makes up for all of their issues. You know, mining stocks could have poor management where the price of gold would not help them. They could make poor decisions where the price of gold will not help them. So when I look at a mining stock, the first thing I do is I just ignore the price of gold and what the price of gold is going to do in the next 6 months, in the next 12 months, in the next 5 years. I take that out of the equation from the beginning, and I start to do the due diligence on the management team, on the properties. I look at the risk management aspect of it. What's the downside here? What's the upside? Not once in the equation do I factor in the gold price until I go through that process.
And you prefer to invest in junior and mid-tier producers, is that right?
I do, and the reason why I do that is just because you know, the larger senior miners have had some difficulties in the past years, especially during this time period. They tend to be, you know, somewhat more levered than maybe the juniors. They may not be as flexible from time to time. It's more of a personal preference. I feel like I've had more success in the junior mid-tier crossovers. So I tend to spend more time in those names.
Let's say you start to think an investment is going wrong or you're second guessing yourself. What is that psychological factor with, you know, you've put yourself out there and you said, I've invested in this company. I think it's good for these reasons. Have you had a struggle with that at all because you're making your positions public?
I have a struggle with it, and I'll be honest with you. When I started tweeting about the companies that I was looking at and investing in, it was never intended to I never thought it would get to the point where it got today. So I'm humbled by the fact that I've got a large audience. The reason I started to do that was to help me in my process and to be able to go back to these tweets that I did and say to myself, compare, you know, what happened after my due diligence and after I took a position, and whether it was a good move or a bad move, and be able to learn from those mistakes. That was the point of why I was doing that. And then it just started to take off beyond any imagination. And so now there's a struggle with, you know, ideas that I may discuss, and they turn out to be, you know, bad ideas. There's sometimes a struggle in my mind about, you know, disappointing people and, you know, being upset about it. But I think at the end of the day, for me, it helps me in my due diligence. I write it down, and I used to write these things down, and I felt that that was not the best way. And so when I did it on Twitter, it really started to make sense. And you'd be surprised because I'll do a tweet storm on a mining stock, and there'll be 15 tweets long, and they're coherent, and it's understandable, and you can read into the logic and why I'm interested in the company. And then I look back into it, you know, a year or two later, and I say to myself, wow, that was a good call, or wow, that was a terrible call, and look. And so now I need to learn from those mistakes, and that's really to me what Twitter has been about. In the process, though, I've met a lot of people on Twitter, people that I probably would have never had conversations with in the past. So Twitter's been a very successful tool for me. I'll continue to keep doing, you know, what I'm doing on Twitter, and hopefully people benefit more than they don't. And if I can help people out along the way, that's great, because I like to share success. I really do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're very open-handed with your successes and humble with your losses, in my opinion, just from reading your tweets. With your approach, you take a fundamental approach. You're looking for value. You're analyzing mining companies as if they're an actual business that's supposed to make money, not just take money from investors. Would you say that perhaps the Achilles heel of your approach could be being caught in a value trap?
I would agree. I have examples of ideas that I invested in that turned out to be value traps. You know, sometimes you look at a company and you say to yourself, wow, the valuations on this are tremendous. You know, what is the market not seeing that I think I'm seeing, or vice versa? And so you take a position because you think it's undervalued and the market's missing it. And then whether it's a combination of timing or just bad luck or the fact that the market was right all along, it's definitely been a scenario. There's been scenarios where I've had some deep losses because of the philosophy and the value trap that went along with it. So what I've learned is, you know, you're never going to be 100% right. And so you have to be able to take losses and confront yourself and say, I made a mistake. I need to move on. And so I've been doing that recently too, with some of the stocks that I bought that looked great on the screener, checked out, the profile checked out, and it just didn't turn out to be that way.
Can you talk about some of your biggest winners over the years and your exit strategy for harvesting and realizing the gains on your winners?
Sure. So I have a few that I'd like to mention. And I'll start with that first one that I invested in, Claude Resources. That, as I said earlier, that was initially my biggest loser, and it eventually turned out to be one of my biggest winners. So with Claude, it was really averaging down into it, which is not necessarily a strategy that I recommend, because it's just, you're going against the tide at that point. And, I feel like luck went in my direction with this one. As I was buying it and then the share price was going down, they discovered a very high grade, gold mine in the process, the Santoy Gap. And that discovery transformed the company. So when it was trading at 14 cents, 20 cents, 25 cents, I was buying it. And the reason why I was buying it was because I was in the name already, knew the management, knew the company, and was there when they made that discovery. And when they made that discovery, it really fundamentally transformed their business from a free cash flow perspective, from a valuation perspective. And so I started to buy 75% of the position under 50 cents a share. Eventually, the company got bought out by Silver Standard at a price that was, I believe, $1.35 Canadian. And it was an all-share deal, and that one really worked out for me. But there's a third piece to that, and it's the hindsight is 2020 piece. You know, they were purchased by Silver Standard. I made a 200-300% return on it. It was a long investment. I was in the name for quite a long time. If you think about the fact that I first bought it in, before the 2008 financial crisis, and my exit on that one was when they were acquired by Silver Standard. There's a lot of time in between that was lost, right? A lot of hardship. But like I said, I learned a lot through that, and the exit on that one was pretty easy. Silver Standard made the exit for me. But I look back at that scenario, even from the exit, had I just accepted Silver Standard shares in exchange, hindsight's 2020, but I would have been so much better off, because then as soon as that deal closed in 2016, the bull market or the period in gold that took it from 1050 to 1300 or so took Silver Standard stock and almost tripled it. So, you know, after hypothetically would have had a huge windfall had I held. So sometimes I think it's difficult, because I tend to dwell on the what ifs a lot, and that catches you a lot as well.
Yeah, this sector can turn so quickly. With that in mind, are there any junior gold stocks that you monitor to kind of gauge the direction of the sector, like a bellwether junior gold stock that you pay attention to?
Typically for me, I'm looking at the seniors to give some sort of direction in the market, because they tend to move first in the early stages of a bull market.
Like a Barrick?
Yeah, like a Barrick, but you know, with Barrick and the Randgold merger, you know, that seems to be driving a lot of the price movement in it, because I think the market sees a lot of value in that deal. But I'll look at a Newmont, you know, I'll look at a Barrick for sure. Really the seniors and kind of see what they're doing. But a lot of the seniors, like, you know, Goldcorp has had their share of issues, and so it's really tough. So you really have to look at some seniors. You have to look at what the ETFs are doing to kind of get a sense of what the market is doing as a whole, and then you have to look at the price of gold as well. But the seniors typically tend to lead in a bull market, in the early stages of a bull market, at least from my opinion.
Do you apply technical analysis to these companies before you invest, or do you apply technical analysis to the GDXJ for timing purposes?
I use technical analysis when I am day trading or when I'm taking a short term position. I don't really use technical analysis as a primary driver when I'm building a position in a company. So I'll just give you, you know, an example of two really viable companies that I have invested in the last 3 to 4 years. Kirkland Lake was one of them. I bought that in 2016, well before they became what they are today. It was a company that just had the Macassa mine, and then they had some other mines that they bought from St. Andrews. And so it was really just a company that had ownership by Eric Sprott and had some decent assets. And then they went on to buy Newmarket Gold, and that gave them the exposure to the Fosterville mine that has transformed the company. I say that because there wasn't really much technical analysis that I applied when I got into Kirkland Lake. I got into Kirkland Lake because it was a high-grade gold mine that was generating cash flow and free cash flow. And then they made this acquisition, which, by the way, the market didn't like. When they did it, the stock went on to fall 30% after they announced it. And I bought more. I started looking into the Fosterville story, and I saw that they were hitting very high grades the deeper they went. So I started buying more. Had I applied technical analysis to this position, I probably would have missed a big part of the run. So I say that because I take two different approaches. I take a core approach where I'm building a position, kind of a concentrated position, if you want to call it, in a company that I'm comfortable with. And then I don't use a whole lot of technical analysis in those positions. It's mainly fundamental analysis and just overall comfort level. And then on the trading side, that's where I apply all my technical analysis, because they're really short term in nature, and I want to get the best buy point and the best exit that I could possibly get.
In terms of portfolio allocation and position sizing, when you do get a winner, that winner obviously is going to become a greater percent of your overall portfolio. What do you cap a winner at? You know, 35% of your portfolio, and then how do you begin to exit that stock?
Kirkland Lake, man, Kirkland Lake was my best success story. And is one I learned a lot from as well, because I was buying Kirkland Lake at $6 a share initially, before they merged with Newmarket. After they merged with Newmarket, I was buying it at $5 a share and $6 a share at $7 a share. And it took some time for the stock to gain traction. It finally did, and it started to move quite rapidly. As it started to do that, it was a concentrated position for me from the beginning. So obviously, the portfolio, Kirkland Lake as a percentage of the portfolio, grew significantly. And I wasn't overall too concerned about it. Yes, it was probably something I had to address, but the story was intact. The fundamentals were getting better, and the valuations were still supported. So I kept holding on to it. And then, within a year, it hit $15 after it listed on the New York Stock Exchange, and I had a nice little gain there. Re-examined my portfolio again, and I said, I probably should be selling some here, given the relative size to the overall portfolio. But I didn't. It went up again, 16, 17, 18. Finally, at around $18, I started saying to myself, I have to start taking some off the table. So I started selling a little bit at 18, and then I started to trade it more regularly. So I kept the core position and then just started to trade the ups and downs on it. And then as it kept going higher, it's now about 24. That actually hit 25 a few days ago. I am probably, I don't have much left of KL. I've got probably 10% of the portfolio in KL now. So for right or wrong reasons, I had to take profits. And I can't look back and say, I regret that decision. But again, hindsight's 2020. It's one of those situations where you're like, had I held, I could have made a lot more. But I needed to free up some capital to buy up some other names, and so the exit's always difficult, especially when you've got a significant gain, because not only is it a big part of your portfolio, but there's also tax considerations that you have to look into and consider, and so that was challenging as well. And sometimes too, a stock goes up significantly, it can go up a lot more, but then it becomes a relative value play. And so I was fortunate enough to allocate some KL money into Wesdome, which is a company that is a core position now for me. And I started building a position in that when it was Canadian $2 a share. And I did a write-up on that on Twitter. It was late May. I did a write-up on it as to why I was buying it. And fortunately, it took off not far after that. Insiders started to buy as well. And now the stock is at Canadian 365, so it's almost doubled from the point of initial purchase. And so, you've got to look at a lot of different factors when you're exiting a position, and certainly don't want to be in a portfolio where one company is a significant part of your overall position. Now, again, this is money that is investment money for me. It's money that I'm comfortable, losing. With that in mind, you just have to follow the process, and you'll know when it's time to exit, whether it's too soon or too late. That's hindsight. You just can't really know if it's the right time. You just have to do it.
As U.S. investors, you touched on the tax issue. Here in the States, for those that don't know, we're taxed at a lot higher rate, or the regular income tax rate, if we sell and harvest our gains within a year. If it's more than a year, then we're charged at a flat rate, long-term capital gains. So you touched on that, Luis. So when you had that Kirkland Lake win, were you waiting for that year before you began to harvest some of those gains? Because I know, as a fellow U.S. investor, that's something that I've struggled with as well.
I started harvesting the KL gains this year predominantly. So the tax bill is going to be due on that in April. it's going to be, the way I look at it is, I'd rather have a tax bill than not, right? And that's why it's also important to sort of harvest gains, because you just never know what's going to happen in the mining sector. It's one of those sectors where anything is possible on any given day. And, you know, you just don't want to have a large gain and have it go away because, you know, you were looking to gain a little bit more. So, you know, the KL story is still strong and vibrant. I still own some of it. I think it's going to go higher. Fosterville and the Swan Zone are pure drivers and will continue to economically benefit that company. But Mikasa is not far behind. They're building a new shaft there and they're going to get to 1 million ounces per year and be a senior miner in 3 to 5 years. And they're executing. And the thing I've learned in mining is there aren't very many good mining stocks to buy at any given time, especially as an investment. I don't look at necessarily mining stocks as investments. They're more speculation. But then there are a handful that you actually can say, wow, this is a legitimate investment because you're looking at it as a business. And as a business, they're doing well. They're operating well. They're executing well. They're exploring well. And everything seems to be going right. Whereas some other mining companies, they're just hoping for the price of gold to kind of offset some of their challenges. And so that's why there's not a whole lot of time that's required once you find a company that you think is investable, because once you find that, there may be only a handful at any given time. And so you just kind of stick to those.
You could follow Luis at Economic Alpha on Twitter, as we've mentioned. Luis, I'm looking at your Twitter account right now. It says direct message for bespoke work. Is there anything you want to share about that?
I get DMs all the time, people asking me questions. I haven't monetized any of my work. I don't know if that's the path I want to take. Again, I wasn't expecting the kind of success on Twitter that I had received and that I've been fortunate to see. So I'm at a point in my life right now where, you know, I've got a very good career and I've got this mining situation that has worked out well so far. So right now I'm at a point where I'm just kind of balancing the two and enjoying, you know, the experience that I'm learning in the industry and the people that I've met and the help that I've gotten along the way. So, you know, I believe in, you know, just sharing knowledge. I do believe it's probably something that I could charge for, and I know that there would be significant demand for it. But I'm not so sure that that's the path I want to take right now. And so I'll just continue to do what I'm doing now. And I know that good things will come regardless of the direction I take. So, you know, the DM aspect is really just people reach out to me, ask me questions about different mining stocks, and I'll get back to them. You know, I don't charge them for it. It's just my opinions. And people really appreciate that. And, you know, I've gotten a lot of good feedback from people where they followed me into Kirkland Lake and they followed me into West Dome. And I've gotten feedback from people through direct message or through email saying that, you know, I've changed their lives. And that to me is probably the best recognition that you can ever get. So that in itself is motivation for me to keep doing what I'm doing.
Besides Twitter, are you online anywhere else?
No. And then that's the thing too. It's tough because if this is all I was doing, and didn't have my career, my corporate career, I could find ways to build an online website, to build a blog and maybe do some research work for people. But it's hard to find the time, and with the kids around, and, you know, we're expecting a third. So there's a lot of moving parts. And I feel like sometimes I'm moving in multiple different directions. Timing has to be right for me to really build an online presence and maybe start doing some blogging or maybe start a service or something to that effect. But I'm still learning in the mining industry. I make mistakes every single day, some costly. I've had costly mistakes. Ascendant Resources was a mistake I made this year. Valuation trap, lost some good money in that. Superior Gold is another one where I recommended not recommended, because I don't consider what I'm saying recommendations. I just consider them my opinions and thoughts. And so I ventured into Superior Gold on a valuation perspective, and it was just bad timing, and the market rolled over, and they weren't executing. So I lost some money in that. So, you know, there have been some really good wins, like Kirkland Lake and Claude and Richmont and Lakeshore Gold. Those have been my biggest winners. Wesdome, I'm currently sitting on a decent gain on that one, and so that one's been a good winner. But you know, while there's been significant winners, there's been some losers too. And the most important thing for me is just cut losses, especially when they're not heading in. When it's not going against when it's going against your thesis, your initial thesis, and why you bought into it. So, yeah, I'm learning every day, and I don't feel like I know everything yet, and that's why I'm not in a position in any way, shape, or form to build out anything at this point in time.
Well, Luis, I know you took time away from the kids to chat with me over these 45 or so minutes. I want to thank you for coming on the podcast, and thanks for the chat.
Fantastic, Bill. Thank you for the opportunity to have a discussion. I'm very thankful for that, and I'm looking forward to having many more in the future. And let's hope the mining sector is good for us in 2019.
Sounds great. For millennia, ancient pharaohs prospered from unparalleled riches made possible by Egypt's resource-rich gold deposits. But despite this rich history, modern Egypt remains one of the most underdeveloped gold mining countries in the world. But that's all about to change. Aton Resources is leading the charge on the Egyptian mining revival. As the only public exploration company in Egypt, Aton Resources has first-mover advantage, focused on their 100% owned Abu Marawat concession. Aton Resources is advancing several exploration targets, including the recent discovery of the legendary Lost Mountain of Gold at Rod Ruin. Learn more about this exciting drill program and other news at atonresources.com. Aton trades on the TSXV under the ticker symbol AAN and on the OTC under the ticker ANLBF. Thank you for listening to this Mining Stock Education podcast. Please subscribe and share with like-minded investors. Visit us on the web at miningstockeducation.com for more resources on precious metals and natural resource investing. At our website, you can also sign up for our free newsletter for interview transcripts, stock picks, and more. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be considered personal legal or investment advice or a recommendation to buy or sell securities or any other product. We make every effort to be accurate, but the information presented is not to be considered infallible. It may contain errors, and we offer no inferred or explicit warranty. If personal advice is needed, consult a qualified legal, tax, or investment professional. Do not base any investment decision on the information contained on miningstockeducation.com, our podcasts, or videos. Make sure you always conduct your own thorough due diligence before investing. Realize that we may hold equity positions in or be compensated by some of the companies we feature and therefore are biased and hold an obvious conflict of interest. For our full disclaimer, please visit our website.